Welcome to the Awe and Wonder podcast. I'm Sarah Kinsella.
And I'm Brenda Del Monte.
And today we're joined by Dr. Ting Su, who is a teacher of blind and low vision students. And she coordinates the Northwest Center for Assistive Technology Training, CAT Northwest, at the Washington State School for the Blind. Ting, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here and thanks for the invitation to come and talk to you guys.
Yes, we're glad to have you. Can you tell us a little bit more about that program, the CAT Northwest program?
Yeah, it's a new, very exciting program. It's something that our field has been just desperate for many years. One of the big challenges of being a teacher of blind and low vision students, or otherwise known as a TVI, is that oftentimes we don't get to have the technology that our students need. So while the students might get a device such as a Braille display, or the school might get an embosser, teachers often have a hard time learning the technology because we don't have a device for ourselves to learn from. So what the CAT program is here to do is we can actually help assist bridging that gap so that teachers may have the technology they need to learn. And then we also provide the training that comes with learning the device. We offer guidance on lesson plan development. And it's a lot of community building all around technology learning and training and empowering teachers really to feel like they can also learn the tech and then turn around and train somebody else on the technology.
That's great. Such a nice service. I know that that happens with SLPs as well. Sometimes we work with teams who are supporting a student using AAC, but they don't have access to the device themselves. So that's so nice that you can provide the access for teachers. And previously, you were a professor. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. I originally wanted to get my PhD because I really believed in teacher prep and how that's really how we can seed generations of innovative teachers and build leadership skills. So when I finished my PhD, I really wanted to do teacher prep, and I had this amazing opportunity to coordinate the teacher prep program in visual impairments at San Francisco State University. Never thought I would leave that dream job, and then dream job number two came along.
That's a good feeling.
Yeah.
So great. I love teacher prep in all forms.
Dr. Su, what's your personal story and connection to the world of low vision?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think some people have a personal story or experience with blindness or low vision. I'm one of the people in our field who really fell into the profession. It wasn't anything I anticipated. I never thought I would wanted to be a teacher or work with children. And I had been a physical therapy major in college and the first time grad school. And I realized it just wasn't a good fit. And I found myself in Boston, Massachusetts, and discovered the Perkins School for the Blind. And I just applied for a job there. I thought it was going to be a temporary job just to not have to move home after college. And quickly fell in love with the profession and just, it was in the deafblind program at Perkins School for the Blind. So I was working with kids who didn't have typical communication skills. And it was sort of the ultimate mystery, unlocking how to set up alternative communication systems for kids who didn't have traditional means of communicating. And then taking that a step further, understanding the role that technology and AAC, as you well know, and how important that can be for a child to really be able to connect with the world and communicate, because, without communication, you can't really get anywhere with education.
So what year was this? Not to date you, but what year was this when you were in the School for the Blind at Perkins?
Yeah, I was at Perkins in 2002.
Okay.
So yeah, I worked as a paraprofessional in that program for about 2 years, and then I ended up working as a para for a preschool for the deaf and hard of hearing, and then decided to go to grad school actually for deafblindness.
Before the iPad, before eye gaze devices were really that accessible for children as well. I mean, you're probably doing switches and that kind of thing. Is that kind of the communication system you were doing?
Yeah, learned tactile sign kind of on the job. Perkins provided us with ASL.
Wow.
And we're actually required to sign on the job, even in conversation. So it would be kind of a fully accessible environment for all the students in the program. And then, yeah, that's how I learned about switches. And just, I've always had just a love for working with students who are on kind of AAC and switch programs and the deafblind population. It's really where I started.
Wow.
Did you say you worked with younger preschool age students?
Yes, it was I initially was in the Bridgman residential program.
Okay.
So it was actually working with the students after school, and it was the youngest population. So probably the youngest was around 5 years old up through about 12
Okay.
age range. And then that was my initial time. And then I finished my years at Perkins in the school program. So I got to see both sides of both residential and academic programs there.
Oh, neat. Okay. And so, what were some of the communication systems that students used?
Yeah, I would say in the residential program, it really was tactile sign, just because we're pretty much on the go a lot. The students mostly use the switches in the academic day program, so that's where I see more of like the access technology or assistive technology. In the cottage after school, it was really just more low tech and signing.
And can you explain a little bit about what tactile sign is?
Oh, sure. It's just as you're using sign language, the person who's receiving the communication will have their hands on top of the signer's hands. And so they can actually feel your hands moving and your hand shapes as you're signing.
Do you serve the deafblind community directly, or do you serve those who serve the deafblind community?
Currently, I don't have any students who are deafblind on my caseload. So I do still have a small caseload in the field, so I get to still work in the field a few hours a week. In the past, I have consulted with school teams who had a deafblind student, particularly with figuring out technology needs for the student. Currently, though, through the CAT program, it's more working with the teachers at the teacher training level and sometimes parent groups and community groups.
And the students that you are seeing in the field, they're students with low vision or CVI?
Yes, they have low vision needs as well as CVI. So, in my kind of part-time itinerant capacity, I just work with a couple school districts. It's just one day in the field a week. It's kind of the best way to unplug from the big job. And it's really truly the day where I feel my happiness about being in the field. Of course, in addition to working with teachers, which I also love. So yeah, the students right now, I've got two students with extensive support needs, who have pretty intensive communication needs as well. And that's really just so fun for me to go back to my roots and go back to serving that population. And then I have a few low vision kids with some academic needs as well.
I think that we hear a lot of conflicting information about vision because most communication device specialists are SLPs. So we don't have much on vision. So I know that I have learned a lot through the field that the paperwork does not always reflect the vision. There seems to be such variability. To me, vision's like a fingerprint. Like, I'm not even sure any of us has the same exact vision. I don't know. But can you explain some of the terms as you understand them?
Yeah, and I love that metaphor you just suggested about vision being a fingerprint because every student really is unique in how they use their vision. I think it's really more about the functional use of not just their vision, but also a student's senses that defines their needs for access more than a diagnosis. And sometimes you see a vision diagnosis and it can, in practice, be very different from student to student who share the diagnosis. Other times, you might not even have a diagnosis on the record. When I come in and I see a student, I immediately I'm like, oh, there's some vision stuff going on here.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I've had kids with CVI, cerebral visual impairment, through like the whole spectrum of needs from kind of very low functional vision to actually having very usable vision. And then kind of as the brain adapts and learns and makes connections, the vision can also change. I've had actually two students in my career where they ended up getting their driver's licenses. Very interesting to me.
Yes. What do we know about vision variability based on some any kind of like cognitive load? Like as things get more challenging in the environment or in the education or in life, like I feel like sometimes I think sometimes my kids in entertainment seem like they can see well because there's no demand on them for their vision, right? They seem like they're watching the movie. But then when you get to where you're doing an educational task and they're having to use their vision on top of a cognitive load, we're seeing, oh, maybe they don't see as well. Am I making that up? Is that observation incorrect? Or is there such a thing as kind of taxing the visual system with a cognitive load when it's already compromised?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's something that I have observed as well in my experiences. The idea of like cognitive load and how that impacts how one uses their senses, I think is sort of the crux of the issue. Especially for kids with CVI, there's a challenge with multitasking information in general. So in any case where I think a child has challenges multitasking how they process information, you might see that a child is not using their vision as much when the cognitive load goes up. Being they're not getting information, it just might mean that they're not using their vision for information. It might be they're having to rely on different senses as well. And I think in that way, it's our jobs not to perpetuate ableist perspectives about vision and thinking that vision is the only and superior way to access information. I think this can be true for kids who have low vision as well, where, sometimes if they've been working a lot, maybe their visual systems get tired, they might need to go back to their auditory systems or even tactile systems for engaging with information. And I think, our jobs as educators, but also training parents and IEP teams, school teams, is ensuring that whether it's visual, auditory, tactile, kinesthetic, that there is not like a superior value based on vision. It's more about what can the child still accomplish and type of sensory access.
Isn't that interesting that we've decided if they've accessed it through vision, that's a higher level of something. You make a really good point there.
Yeah, and I like that strengths-based approach that you're taking towards it. You said that when you go into a classroom, you can just see right off the bat if the student has something impacted with vision. What are some of those things that make you think that, or that you observe?
Yeah, I guess sometimes, going back to people kind of prioritizing vision, a student might appear like they're not paying attention because they're looking away. Or, teachers are always like, look at this, look at this, and some students, they can't look while they're hearing information. And so I see that, sometimes it's just those behaviors of disengagement where actually maybe their vision systems just need a rest, or maybe they're literally unable to see what's being presented, so they need to focus on using their ears instead. It might be students who really need a break during highly visual tasks or activities, or those students, particularly students who might have some CVI going on. Usually there's some kind of red flag other diagnoses, anything that involves sort of the brain. I always think, oh, could these interruptions in your typical brain processes also be interrupting how they process visual information? So sometimes it's partially the file review that tips me off and just kind of like, prompts me to focus on vision in some way. Sometimes it's the behaviors that we're seeing in the classroom. And sometimes it's just seeing how much a kid is dependent on, quote unquote, sighted assistance. And I start thinking, wow, well, Is there some technology or some other accommodations that could facilitate the students' interdependence? And that we with that we can see diminishing behaviors as well.
What are those pieces of technology?
I could talk all day about technology, so dangerous question to ask. I really love what I refer to as the low-hanging fruit of access technology. And this means technology can be any sort of tools or systems that help people access information better. And not just accessing information, but engaging with information. It could be as simple as, turning on text-to-speech on any kind of program or, any sort of web browser. It could be just making the text bigger, whether you're just in a Google Doc or if you're, using the reader toolbar in the Google Chrome browser. It could just be using a fat marker or a dark pencil, and being able to write a little bit larger than your peers. As a student is using these different sorts of low-hanging fruits of access technology, these are ways that we can encourage them to develop their alternate sensory systems. So, developing auditory access by using text-to-speech, learning to use those low vision technology when you're just maximizing or enlarging font. And then, the students will usually kind of hit a wall. I like to wait for them to hit a wall where they're like, wait, we want more. We want something more robust. I want to listen to information faster. Or, hey, I need better resolution when I enlarge something. And that's kind of the golden spot, the sweet spot for introducing more specialized assistive technology, such as, a magnification tool or a screen reader technology. Sometimes students need a braille display. Of course, braille displays are often best introduced when they're learning braille from the very beginning. I'm a big fan of just introducing technology as soon as students are seeking information about their environment and needing access to information in their media.
Which happens pretty young.
Well, what I like about the golden spot, what stuck out to me with that is that they're self-advocating. They're saying, "Oh, I need this bigger, I need this resolution higher, I need this thing." And even on AAC, when I if I have an iGaze user that is that has CVI or something like that, all iGaze devices can also be switch access. So I usually have a thing that says, "I want my switches." Like tell me when your eyes are not can't do this anymore, and I can even put the device behind you if you want me to. Tell me when you want your switches. And I do love when you reach that point where they can say, "I need my switches," or "I need my," or on their switches and saying, "I can try my eyes," because the point is that I hate if I could only be. I mean, I always say this: if I could only be in a body, somebody else's body for 5 minutes, like right, let me just jump in here for a minute. Literally 5 minutes, and let me know what it feels like, what it sounds like, what it looks like to be in your body, right? And then I can help you. But since I can't, and communication is challenging, I have to be sure I give you the vocabulary to be a self-advocate. But I love that. I agree that that golden spot is when they are aware of their sensory system and what's taxed and what's needed around that.
And I especially get excited when kids become so proficient that they can decide how they want to interact with information and change up their tools, and they've got flexible access now, and that's really the goal.
So, what are some myths about people with low vision that you think should be addressed?
This is just my own personal
Of
opinion.
course, that's why you're on here. We want your personal opinion.
I think one of the biases that I come across the most is that when you have a student with low vision, that they're only shown low vision devices or strategies for using their vision and maximizing their vision. And I think what's missed most often is giving these students with low vision alternate ways of accessing. So, making sure they also have tools for auditory access. And I would also argue that there are many cases where students have low vision, and although they might have some usable vision, they actually could be candidates for Braille and be Braille readers. So, I do wish that, again, it's going back to like vision being kind of over prioritized in some situations. I think there are some missed opportunities to enable low vision students to feel more proficient and more confident and more independent in how they can engage with the world if we can give them, more alternatives with technology.
Okay, I have a vocabulary question, right? Teachers of low vision and blind learners, right, is what we used to call TVI, teacher of the visually impaired. That's a change in vocabulary, right? Are students with CVI also considered low vision? Are those used interchangeably?
Ooh, you know what? That probably depends on who you talk to. So I don't know if I really want to define that. And it's also very personal whether people want to identify as having low vision or just being visually impaired. So traditionally, it's been teachers of the visually impaired, so TVI. And then the pendulum swung way over to person-first language, and then it became teachers of students with visual impairments. And there's been pretty strong outcries from the disability community that they want to have pride in their disability and kind of owning, like, yes, I'm blind. Yes, I have low vision. And so part of my way of honoring kind of the requests from my friends in the disability community is kind of shifting my own language to say that I'm now a teacher of blind and low vision students. And I've also seen the impact with my own students who have low vision, going from, oh, I'm a student who's visually impaired, and it's like I have this impairment or I have this loss of vision, to now just, oh, I'm a low vision learner. I'm a low vision kid, and I just need these tools. So.
How does your approach vary if you're working with a child with a diagnosis who is has degenerative vision or likely to lose vision, but they have it now?
This is probably one of the more complex teaching situations. There's a lot of emotions involved. The psychosocials really come into play about, how the family interprets this diagnosis and how this diagnosis has been conveyed to the student. I think this is a situation where it is of utmost importance to make sure the student is developing their auditory skills, their tactile skills, so that it becomes very kind of standard that they've got all these three different ways of accessing information. And so, maybe some days if, vision is not working so well or it becomes more taxing, it's very easy to then switch to auditory mode. Auditory most often becomes the bridge when a student is transitioning from print to braille. So I think making sure that these different sensory systems are well developed can really empower that student to feel like they can still continue to do whatever it is they like, as their vision changes.
I think when I work with families that say, oh yeah, they're likely to lose their vision or their hearing or both. So, I don't know if any of this is going to work when we're looking at communication devices, And my sense kind of is, well, let's feature match the skills of the persons right now. Right? Because none of us have the crystal ball of when or if that's going to go. And some of them do have diagnosis where hearing and vision could, some kids with a diagnosis are very low hearing, some are very, a CMV comes to mind, that sometimes these kids have profound hearing loss and their vision's pretty good, and sometimes their vision's really low and their hearing is their relative strength, but because of the diagnosis, you can have degenerative hearing, you can have degenerative. So I think if you play around with that what if game, we might get paralyzed and not make any decision at all, and they lose out on that. So I think you're right, like diversifying the way that they receive information so that we can, because we don't know what's going to happen. So we, whether or not you have degenerative or not, to be honest, that should be the approach, right? Because they deserve to have access information in lots of different ways. So I think that degenerative piece, you're right. It's there's a lot of emotions around it. And not only when I work with young children, so not I don't know how aware the children are that that's the diagnosis, but the parents sure are, right?
Yeah, and that's when that parent education piece and parent empowerment piece comes is so important too, is also connecting the parents to other parents, of if you can find parents of a child with that similar diagnosis. In my case, it's connecting parents with parents of blind children. Sometimes the parents might not be ready to face that possible reality. So maybe it's connecting with other parents who are in a similar situation, so that they've got some sort of network among themselves.
Is there a network that you know of, I guess in Washington State, since that's where you are, that for parents to have that connection, or is it just kind of word of mouth through your therapist or your community?
So the National Federation of the Blind, NFB, they do have a parent chapter, and it is called Parents of Blind Children. So this is a nice chapter to get in touch with. I'm not sure how active they are in Washington, but I do know that every state has a chapter. So that's a nice kind of initial good first stop. It's a very sort of empowerment focused sort of organization as well, with access to a lot of role models who are blind, working, living their best life, I also want to give a shout out to Jessica Chandler. She is the early intervention specialist at the Washington State School for the Blind, and WSSB is also where the CAP program is hosted from. And Jessica Chandler runs a really excellent, Birth to Three program, and I know she does a lot of organizing with parents of the children that she works with.
Yeah, she's great. Okay, thank you. That's a great resource for people who are listening and then across the nation to know that there are other similar resources available.
Are
Great.
there any other myths that you want to bust?
Yeah, sure. Let's bust another one. The myth that children with disabilities are fragile. Yes, some children you have to be more are more delicate if what there's a medical condition involved. But for a lot of children who are just blind or who just have low vision or who just have some communication needs, we shouldn't bubble wrap them. I always want to encourage parents to think of the experiences that they want to expose their other children to, or that they see kids in the community being exposed to, and focus instead on how can I create some access points for my child. Getting our kids with disabilities out there and in the world, and having fun and part of recreation activities, and just being part of things, part of the world.
It's a myth that maybe needs to be busted is that low vision equals low cognition.
Yeah, definitely. Or no, you actually don't need to speak louder.
Right, my ears work just fine. Do you see that though? Do you see assumptions around cognition with low vision?
Maybe not so much with low vision. I think the assumptions that I hear about more often is, well, you don't look like you have low vision. And so sometimes it's that misunderstanding out in the community of what low vision really is. Or, hey, you're carrying a cane, but I also see you reading a book or looking at your phone. Like, are you faking it? So, those sorts of assumptions can be very damaging, especially to our teens with low vision who are just trying to be out and about and having fun as a teenager. And then they get, some bullying in the community.
That's interesting. And that's why we like doing this podcast, because it brings to light these things that maybe people haven't thought about, and other perspectives.
What percentage of the population is considered blind, is considered low vision? Do you know?
Well, visual impairment is considered a low incidence disability, meaning that it's typically present in like 0.04% of the population. But when it comes to percentages of how many of our students are blind or how many of our students have a visual impairment, there's very fuzzy wuzzy numbers about it. Those numbers really are difficult to track because of how they're reported. So in some state systems, if there's an additional disability, then it doesn't get reported as a visual impairment. So the American Printing House for the Blind, APH, it's the federal entity that does a census of kids with visual impairments who qualify for materials from APH. So their census numbers are probably the closest thing we have to numbers. But even then, there might be some other kids who are not part of the census who do have a visual impairment but are just missed in the census. So
So in the census, do they count CVI as blind and low vision?
great question. So APH actually just changed their eligibility requirements. And so I'm hoping that with this shift, it will mean that more students will qualify and more students who need accessible instructional materials and technology will be able to access the resources from APH. So right now, if a student qualifies to access resources from APH, what does that give them access to?
Yeah, so APH has a whole catalog of things that range from, Braille materials. You have accessible instructional materials like adapted books, tactile materials. There is a selection of assistive technology, which is what the CAT program supports. There's, low vision devices. And so things that are available for purchasing at no cost to the school district because it's covered in the federal budget, they're considered like on quota. So things that are marked on quota, these are things that they can order through pooled funding that is allotted to each student who is in the census, if that makes
Oh,
sense.
okay. Okay. And then in
Okay.
Washington State, there's an outreach team that works with maybe the schools or the families directly to look at assistive technology, right?
Yes, so Washington is in such a great kind of predicament of having a wealth of opportunities and resources. So there's the Outreach Access Services team. So with the outreach team, it's a smaller team of teachers where they kind of travel around the state and provide support with assistive technology, evaluation, and instruction. They do more of the on-the-ground work, working with particular student or school teams and really addressing needs at the student level. It's a little bit different from the CAT program, where the CAT program actually covers a 10-state and territory region. So we're covering Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Alaska, Hawaii, American Samoa, Guam, and Northern Mariana Islands. And so we teach, we're more of like a consultation and training model where we're training teachers and we're kind of helping bridge gaps in technology in the communities and making sure community partners can support the technology that might be implemented in those spaces. But we don't do as much of the direct service at the student level, if that.
Wow, that's quite a reach.
Yeah, it's really
Yeah,
cool. But
it
then
sure
again,
is.
our scope is very limited to the technology available from APH, whereas the outreach team at WSSB, they can really cover the whole broad spectrum of AT needs for blind and low vision students.
Right, okay. So they may be talking about accessible technology in addition to assistive technology and those tools that are built into devices, like you mentioned before.
Yeah, so with the CAT program, for example, there's two Braille devices that are available from APH. So we really only provide the training related to those two Braille devices, but there's many other brands and flavors of Braille devices that the outreach team can support. Same thing with the video magnifiers and different types of screen readers as well.
How young have you do you go with exposing to Braille? Do you start in birth to three?
Well, my formative years as a teacher of blind and low vision students was actually in early intervention. So Just working with infants all the way through the preschool years. Our CAP program supports birth to 22 students. And I think, if it's pretty clear that a student's going to need Braille and they're going to be a Braille reader, then they should be exposed to Braille as soon as a typically sighted kid might be exposed to print. Picture books, years, there should be Braille there. There should be Braille on any signs that are available, posters that are available around the house, and really enriching the environment with Braille, just like a typically sighted kid would have an enriched environment with print. So even putting Braille labels on the cereal box.
Interesting. And even how we often say with students who are learning to communicate with symbols, to make it part of the environment and modeling that. And what are some first steps a family could take when their child is first identified as blind or low vision learner?
Yeah, I think of course you have the initial psychological, dealing with psychological issues and the emotional issues, helping the parents through that grieving process. And once they're ready to embrace the new experience that they have laid out with them, I think it goes back to, again, just emphasizing that, it's okay for the family to maintain all the experiences they would have typically provided for other kids in the family. And, again, getting the kid out there and really shifting the focus to ensuring access to the activities and, maybe having to do a little bit more work in the community to advocate for accessibility in the movie theater, accessibility in team sports, in, arts and recreation and leisure activities, those sorts of things. And so, yeah, it's going to take a little bit more advocacy work, but the expectation should be that their child is seen as an equal member in their community and in their family, just as any other child.
How can parents advocate for a specialist within the school system?
Well, I think it actually begins a lot earlier than that, and hopefully there's been a good child find system and there's a doctor who can get the parents hooked up to early intervention. I think having good early intervention is so important. That's when you first start working with an education specialist, a TVI, an orientation mobility specialist. And hopefully, if you've got a really good early intervention team, then that's the team that coaches you to know what questions to ask and what things to advocate for when you shift to school. And, even if a parent has, didn't get the resources they needed in early intervention, it's not too late to advocate for those early interventions in school. This is where I think it's really important for parents to connect with other parents so that they can inform each other and educate one another on, hey, did you ask about this? Make sure you advocate for this. And, parents can also reach out sometimes if there's a university program, so a TVI or O&M prep program. Sometimes universities are in a position where they can help bridge some of those education gaps as well. I know when I was at San Francisco State, I would often field calls from parents who just didn't know where else to start. Some of the larger metropolitan cities might also have a Lighthouse for the Blind. So Lighthouses for the Blind also may have some either youth programs. I know the San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind has an excellent early intervention program, but they can also be another hub for resources.
Great. Yeah, good resources. When you worked with or currently work with teams that include the SLP because you're looking at communication systems for a student, what are some factors that the SLP should consider or the whole team should consider when looking at a student's communication systems from your perspective as a TVI?
I have had a lot of experiences collaborating with SLPs and AAC specialists, and it's very interesting because everybody has such different experiences, and everybody has their bias in like what system is the system for a child.
It's tribal for sure.
Is it okay? It's not just me. My biggest challenges have been in kind of, again, getting away from vision being the primary way to access a communication system. So, I've Probably the most challenging experience I've ever had was working with a functionally blind child, and they had a completely visual icon-based AAC system. And they knew the child couldn't see any of the buttons on the Go Talk. They're like, oh, well, he'll just learn that, this button means eat or this button means outside. And, it's sort of like, well, let's go back to what's actually a meaningful representation for the student. So, do we need a tangible symbol? Do we need some sort of tactile marker that's going to, be a better representation than a picture icon that they can't see? So, sometimes it's just kind of rethinking the presentation and really, again, going back to the accessibility of a system, and really emphasizing what is a meaningful representation for a child, particularly with students who don't have a lot of functional vision. Abstracted representations can be very difficult to learn with communication symbols. So, I love tangible symbols. So kind of like the 2.5D, like for example, from Adaptive Design Association in New York City, they made these great tangible symbol communication cards. And it'll be like, the top of a Tupperware, or the seatbelt buckle. So very, very concrete, meaningful representations of what that symbol means. And so it's kind of fun rethinking a communication system in terms of what's the most meaningful for a student.
So how does a student gain more and more vocabulary with the tangible symbols
Well, it gets cumbersome, right? You have 100
that you
tactile
have, right?
symptoms, and the speech therapist is wanting to increase language, and now we've got to make, where is what kind of wagon are we pulling with all the tactile systems? So, but I think what you're saying is there's tactile systems for some basic needs, and then we're increasing vocabulary in other ways because the tactile system is limited by space, weight, logistics. Am I right?
Yeah, but it's often a start. It's just a start to kind of like start the communication
The
routine.
communicative intent is proven at
Yeah.
that point.
Yes. And
Yeah.
you mentioned some, let's see, you said tactile symbols, but then you also said like tactile indicators.
Yeah, I think about like the guards that come on the PRC devices. They have little indicators and dots and things on there so that you can know what row you're on and different things on the key guards even that let them give some orientation to the screen. And I have seen completely blind people use the screen and just know location, right? And they figure that all out. But I do know that the children I work with most, they're not using their hands well, and they're not using Braille because their hands are fisted because of their cerebral palsy or whatever. So that I feel like the tactile pieces that are on key guards can be super helpful for those that are functional with their hands. But if you're not functional with your hands, then the Braille and the key guard and all that stuff ends up becoming not accessible.
So I am a big fan of switches, whether it's just like a single switch where you click a switch and it says something. The step by steps I actually have not used as much because it's a oh, you're the experts, but it's a more advanced level of using a switch when you have several layers programmed into the step by step. But I just love switches for helping kids develop that cause and effect and nurturing that communicative intent. So, I
I
don't
with birth
know.
to three though on the step by step, I will like Itsy Bitsy Spider went up the water spout and then they gotta hit it again. Down came the rain, right? The cognitive load is still really low. The entertainment is high, and they're learning that you keep the conversation going, you keep the song going by hitting the switch again. So there are very simple ways to use the to step by step to kind of teach that piece as well. But I agree that that switches can be used for all again. Even my kids that don't have any visual impairment and but they're on eye gaze can't control everything, and switches control lots of things in our environment. So we all of our kids with significant physical disabilities need to have switch access as they're moving forward for sure. I was thinking about one other thing that some of them have is what's, I think it's on the Nova Chat, it's called phishing. So you hear you can hear the what each button is. So it might be like music, books, outside, and when you hear the one you want, you hit it again and it says, I want to go outside. So my kids with that could like maybe hold their hand across the top of a device, they could kind of feel across a garden, do those kinds of things. There's always things that are coming out that are like, oh, and then you know what? You meet the kid that can do it and you're like, well, there we go, right? That's the great thing
Totally.
about technology.
Yeah. And I mean, the iPads are so cool too with the switch access and what you can do
Yeah.
there. I love Christopher Hill's stuff and his YouTube channel and all the ways he shows how he uses switches in just normal day-to-day things.
Right.
Well, and this whole conversation is just a good reminder that, like you mentioned before, Dr. Sue, the collaborative approach is so important because we don't know it all. We can't all know everything. So just being able to talk to each other, there's such valuable information to be gained from each other.
And that no one particular system is is more important than the other one. And that's where I think as team members, we have to start to be better collaborators and not hierarchy every sensory system, right?
Yeah, and I think, everybody, myself included, we benefit from ableism checks every now and then. Yeah,
Right.
that's great. Great point. So we will share the link to the Cat Northwest information. Are there any other resources that you think would be helpful to share today?
Oh, sure. Since we're on the topic of switches, I definitely want to give a nod to Bruce McClanahan. He was a longtime statewide assistive technology specialist for Washington State and just retired from WSSB last fall. But they're still maintaining his website with a lot of resources. And Bruce's resources on switch access was always one of my go-tos. So big fan of Bruce McClanahan and all the years of work he put into documenting like all the different ways switches could be set up for kids. I've been a longtime fan of how social media can help us bridge gaps in our communities of practice and how it can help connect educators across big distances. Of course there's Facebook, but there's also a lot of activity on Instagram now. One of my favorite people in the alternate media and assistive technology space, his name is Neil McKenzie, and he develops really great tactile learning aids, 3D prints, and he's always thinking about accessible workflows for our blind and low vision kids. So his social media handle is Neil, spelled NEAL, the number 4, and then A11Y for accessibility. So Neil
Okay,
4,
great.
A11Y.
Great.
And of course, finally, I really highly recommend the Perkins Paths to Technology newsletter. This is a fantastic newsletter. It comes out not too often, I would say once or twice a month, and it's always got the latest sorts of tips and apps and helpful information when it comes to technology for our blind and low vision students.
Oh, nice.
Great. I'm familiar with Perkins, but I didn't know about their newsletter. So I'm
Me
definitely
neither.
going to do that. Yeah. Thank you so much.
No, I just wanted to say thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast. It's really fun connecting with SLPs and really talking, of course, talking tech, but also just recognizing the importance of communication and what more there is for us to do in this space.
For sure. I feel like we're going to look back and say, man, we were in the infancy there, right? That there's so much more to go. But the collaboration between the TVI and the SLP is essential. So we're hoping that this whole series is bringing that to light. So thank you for shining on that.
Yeah, thank you both.
The contents of this podcast were developed under contract with the Washington Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, U.S. Department of Education, and administered by Central Washington University. However, those contents did not necessarily represent the policy of the OSPI and CWU, and you should not assume endorsement by the federal and state government.